I left this story a few weeks ago with Tony Blair. And Tony Blair, who had transformed the Labour Party, even changed the name and called it New Labour, changed its politics by marginalising the left, by expelling some Marxists from the party, by changing the constitution so that Clause 4, fundamentally a Marxist clause, was eliminated and replaced by something much more general about justice and values and so on. By increasing the power of members of parliament in the party and reducing the power of trade unions and local activists. How else did he transform the party? By increasing the importance of new technology and reducing the importance of traditional politics, knocking on people's doors and giving out leaflets. Not on the market. That's a French tradition, to give out leaflets on the market. In Britain, they give out leaflets on Saturday at the supermarket. How else did Tony Blair transform the Labour Party? Well, by declaring we don't have a problem with rich people. And showing in his personal life, he went on holiday with the richest people in the world, that it was a different kind of Labour Party. And fundamentally reinforcing the section of the party that thought there is no need for conflict between workers and bosses. This was Tony Blair's Tony Blair's idea is that the power of the markets and of the financial markets is inevitable. So to oppose the power of the market and the financial markets, in Tony Blair's opinion, is a waste of time. You cannot win. These are inevitable things. And so the question for the Labour Party is different, in Tony Blair's opinion. It's what can we do in the space which is left? This meant that in some areas, when he came into government, he did not change the things which Margaret Thatcher and John Major had done. He did not renationalise the things which had been privatised. Even when it was possible, at certain moments, it was certainly possible to renationalise the railways. The privatisation had been a disaster in the railways, not in every industry, and the public would probably have supported. But he had decided, nationalisation was old labour, and so that was not to be done. He did not change most of the laws about trade unions. The laws about picketing, about solidarity strikes, remained in place. But he did do some things for the trade unions. I think I mentioned this last time. Did I mention this? Some of the things he did for the trade unions. First of all, he introduced a minimum wage. For the first time in history, there was a minimum wage in Britain. Not very high, but that's a very important reform, of course. A legal minimum wage is the trade unions were very happy. It's a big reform. Before the minimum wage, it was possible to hire people for €2 an hour. And people did. People did work for almost nothing, legally. And so the minimum wage was an important change. So it's not true that Tony Blair left many of the things that Margaret Thatcher and John Major had done, but it's not true that he reformed nothing. Secondly, he passed a reform which made it easier for trade unions to work. This reform said if in a company a certain percentage of workers want a trade union, in this case the management are obliged to negotiate with the trade union. This is a kind of law about the rights of trade unions, which is of American inspiration, and it helped the trade unions. Il y avait le droit à avoir un référendum dans une boîte. Est-ce que vous voulez un syndicat? Et dépasser un certain pourcentage, je crois que c'est 40%. Je ne suis pas sûr et certain. Alors, dans ce cas-là, l'encadrement est obligé de négocier avec le syndicat. Point. Il ne peut pas refuser. Okay. So some things got better for trade unions. Tony Blair made big changes in other areas, in particular in the constitutional areas. The House of Lords was completely transformed. The power of the hereditary aristocrats was fundamentally eliminated. It was an enormous reform. The House of Lords before 1958 was only composed of hereditary aristocrats. Like it's, when you say House of Lords, you imagine aristocrats. And this was true, completely true, before 1958. After 1958, it was a mix. Some hereditary aristocrats and some people nominated by the prime ministers. After 1999, there are very few hereditary aristocrats. So this is a big change. That is, in 1996, the majority of the House of Lords was people who were lords because their father was lords. That's it. After, only a small minority of the House of Lords are there because of the hereditary principle. So this is a big constitutional change. Why? Well, certainly the idea of hereditary power is obviously more controversial today than 50 years ago. Even the Queen has been obliged to change things. About 10 or 15 years ago, I think it's 92, the Queen agreed for the first time to pay income tax. Elle n'avait pas l'obligation de payer l'impôt sur le revenu. Il y a eu un accord en 93, je crois, pour qu'elle le paye. Why? Because it's no longer politically acceptable just because you're the son of somebody. It's becoming a delicate principle. Now, most people in Britain do not want a republic, but they want the Queen to recognise the democratic spirit of the modern world, and so a queen that refuses to pay her taxes when she's extremely rich, that was no longer acceptable. And so some changes are being made. And now the hereditary principle has disappeared in the House of Lords. In some ways, the Queen is rather isolated now. Because before 1999, there was the Queen and the House of Lords, and so the hereditary principle was kind of accepted in the political system. And now there's only the Queen. Yeah? I think she will survive. They're very flexible people. And of course, now there's going to be a new baby. Oh, isn't that exciting? No, it isn't, no. Okay, right. Important change. More important changes by Tony Blair. He established a Supreme Court, une Cour suprême. Not like the American Supreme Court, not so important, because Britain is not such a legal, the same sort of legal culture. But nevertheless, the top appeal court in Britain before 1999 or before 2000 and something was the House of Lords, and today it is the Supreme Court. It's a new institution. So certainly Tony Blair was somebody who said, oh yeah, let's change the House of Lords, change the Supreme Court. You know that the British don't often change their major institutions. This was something exceptional. He also introduced the Freedom of Information Act, a new law, the Freedom of Information Act. Again, an American-style idea. And what does the Freedom of Information Act say? Well, it says if you want information about government or public sector activity, you have a right to this information. Yeah. So, for example, supposing there was an important meeting, supposing we were in Britain, and there was an important meeting of the university council here, and you want the details of what happens. Before the Freedom of Information Act, you can't have it. And after the Freedom of Information Act, you have a right to this information, except if there is a very good reason. So it's made a big change in this. Okay. Nevertheless, Tony Blair lost a lot of popularity, especially because of the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq was very unpopular. You saw some of the biggest demonstrations in British history against the war in Iraq. And also, the economy, which had a period of being very strong under Tony Blair, began to decline again. Difficult to know exactly why. He was replaced for a few years by Gordon Brown, not quite so young, modern, and dynamic. And in 2010, Gordon Brown lost the election and David Cameron for the Conservative Party became Prime Minister. Perhaps the one thing I forgot to say about Tony Blair is that he was a new image. Young, rapid, sharp, funny, was a very new kind of image for a British Prime Minister who normally was very, very more rigid, yes. And indeed, Gordon Brown was not really capable of being quite so personable. So at the 2010 general election on the 6th of May, the Conservative Party succeeded in getting 306 members of Parliament. Problem is, if you want a majority in the House of Commons, you need 326 members of Parliament. So the Conservative Party was the biggest party, but not they did not have a majority. The Labour Party had 258. And the Liberal Democrats had 57. J'arrive pas à faire le calcul, mais il y en a quelques autres. Il y en a quelques autres. Il y en a une quinzaine d'autres. See, let's see, 6, 5, 3. Vous n'êtes pas fort en maths, non? Il y a combien d'autres? Il y en a 653 en tout. Voilà les trois grandes parties. Il y en a combien d'autres? You can work for a while, for a change. The 258, 315, 316, 315. Il en reste 32, c'est ça? Ou une trentaine, on va dire une trentaine. Allez, on dit 32, c'est pas grave, après. Okay, so you see the problem. The Conservatives do not have a majority. The Labour do not have a majority. However, you could imagine if the Labour and the Liberal got together, they still don't have a majority, but they only need 10 more votes from the independents. It's possible. It was just about possible to have a government with Labour and Liberal, in theory. And this is this is what people expected to happen, because the Liberal Party had run a campaign, an election campaign, which was very negative about the Conservatives. However, they did not agree. They had a few days negotiation, they did not agree. And finally, to everyone's surprise, the Conservatives and the Liberals formed an alliance government, a coalition government. This is very unusual in British politics. There has been no coalition government since the Second World War. It's not like Italy where there's always a coalition. And so you had this rather unusual situation where David Cameron from the Conservative Party and Nick Clegg from the Liberal Democratic Party formed a coalition government. And of course, between the two of them, they have enough people, enough members of Parliament. Now, this was extremely controversial. A lot of people left the Liberal Party because many of the activists in the Liberal Party were really anti-Tories. And even today, the situation of Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, is very difficult. In fact, I think I have never seen a politician in Britain detested like Nick Clegg. It's kind of unusual because, of course, people are angry with David Cameron. If they don't like the government policies, they are angry with David Cameron because he's the Conservative. At the same time, people say, oh, well, David Cameron, he's a Conservative. Of course he will do that. That's life. Whereas Liberal Democrats, leader Nick Clegg, promised the opposite. And so this has been rather difficult. In particular, one very, very public difficulty of Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, was about tuition fees, les frais d'inscription à la fac, qui sont très très chers en Angleterre, comme vous le savez. And Nick Clegg had signed publicly on television a promise not to increase the tuition fees, to oppose the increase in tuition fees. And because of the agreement in government, the tuition fees have passed from £3,000 a year to £9,000 a year. Donc il avait promis de ne pas les augmenter, et il les a augmentés plus que tout autre gouvernement depuis un siècle. Ça a été très mal pris, really. It was because, of course, people imagine that very often politicians don't follow all their promises. But when they promise something very publicly on television and make a big noise about it, it's more delicate. Okay, so what are the big questions since 2010? It's only 2 years ago. Now, at the beginning, it appeared, people think, well, can this survive, this coalition government? It seems very difficult. The Liberal Party and the Liberal members of Parliament generally are not too happy about austerity. But it seems that the government is surviving without too much difficulty. One of the important events last year was that the agreement between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats meant, of course, that the Conservative Party was obliged to make a few concessions to the Liberal Democrats. That's how a coalition works. And one of the concessions is that historically, the Liberal Democrats have always been in favour of voting reform. You know, or you should know, that the present system in elections in Britain is what we call the first-past-the-post system. That is, if you have five candidates in Manchester, the candidate with the biggest number of votes wins. There is only one round, so it's not like in France. Yeah? In France, you have two rounds. Why do you have two rounds? Because in the French system, on se dit que s'il y a cinq candidats, il y en a un qui a 22% et tous les autres ont 19%. Est-ce qu'il a vraiment gagné? C'est ça un peu l'attitude du système électoral français. Vaut mieux avoir un deuxième tour une semaine plus tard avec seulement deux candidats. That's the French way of doing things. In Britain, there has never been this. There has only been one round and a simple majority. No, in fact, not a majority. The largest number of votes is enough. Why is this possible? Well, it's possible because there were two big parties. If there are two big dominant parties, then the British system is not too dangerous, because you never have this situation where you have 10 candidates and one of them wins 11% and therefore is elected. It doesn't happen because they're big parties. However, this means that the British system is very hard for small parties. Yeah. The advantages to the two big parties. Any small party will have tremendous difficulty getting in. Et d'ailleurs, je crois, il y a, les conservateurs avaient 2 millions de voix de plus que le Labour, et le Labour avait 2 millions de voix de plus que les libéraux démocrates. Et vous voyez qu'au niveau des sièges, ça ne marche pas du tout de la même façon. Si vous êtes le troisième parti, vous avez très peu de sièges. Because it doesn't work that way. So, the Liberal Democrats, when they decided to have a coalition with the Conservative Party, said, we have a condition. Now, it was not possible to say, we have a condition, you must change the voting system. That was not possible. But they said, we have a condition, you must organise a referendum around a new voting system. And this is what they did. And the Conservatives said, okay, we are the Conservative Party, we don't want a new voting system, but we agree to organise a referendum. And we will campaign for people to say no, and you, the Liberal Democrats, will campaign for people to say yes. And so, last May, in May 2011, there was a proposal by referendum to replace the present system which has existed for 500 years, with a new system, the alternative vote system. Je ne comprends pas exactement comment ça marche, mais c'est un petit peu dans le genre, on met un premier choix et un deuxième choix sur le bulletin, et s'il n'y a pas une majorité absolue, le deuxième choix est compté, vous voyez, un truc comme ça, pour que ce soit, voilà, j'ai bien expliqué, vous ne trouvez pas? Okay, so, a reform in the voting system which would make life much easier for smaller parties. That's the important thing about it. Population said no. And so the system has not changed. We still have the first past the post system. Or, comment dire en français, le système, le bulletin, non? Suffrage. Uni quelque chose. Uninominal à un seul tour, voilà. Suffrage uninominal à un seul tour. C'est-à-dire qu'il n'y a pas de liste. Il n'y a pas de liste en vote pour un individu, pas pour une liste d'un parti, etc. Okay, so just let me give you the results and then I'll come back on this. So, what happened? 42% of people voted. And of these 42%, 68% said no, and 32% said yes. Okay, so it did not change. Did you have a question there? That's a good question. I don't know, but I have some ideas. The first thing is that you know how people say, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Yeah? And so people have the idea that, well, I don't always like the government, but this is not because of the voting system. And people did not think, I know, what we need is more power to the smaller parties. People were not interested, really. So Labour people and Conservative people said, you know, well, no, we want to win the elections, but we're not worried about the system. That's the first reason. The second reason is rather particular, and that is that one of the reasons why voting for lists is not popular in Britain is that the dynamic of voting for an individual is very strong. And you often hear people, or you sometimes hear people saying, I am Labour, but I always vote Conservative because in my town the Conservative is a very nice man. Yeah. On a ça en France, mais plutôt pour les mairies. Il y a des gens de droite qui votent pour un maire de gauche, surtout dans les petites villes, parce que, tiens, oui, non, mais il est bien, et ça fait 10 ans qu'il est là, il est très bien. Yeah. Not so much for the national elections. But in local elections, you know, it's not the only thing. So I don't have a complete answer, but it is a good question. Right, okay, so here we have then this new Conservative government. It has been, of course, very much criticised by the left, of course. Conservative governments are always criticised by the left, that's normal. In particular, because for social reasons, that is that it seems that today's government in Britain has more rich people from Eton and the most prestigious private schools than before. And so David Cameron is often accused of being a government of millionaires. And it's true, there are a lot of millionaires in the government. Yeah. So this is the criticism. What does this Conservative government trying to do? Well, of course, it has come to power or come to office in the situation of the crisis of Europe, you know, the financial crisis in Europe. When the British elite look at Greece and Spain, they say, we don't want to be next. And so the Conservative government has, in general, been working on an austerity programme. There have been a lot of cuts in social services, in hospitals, and so on. And the general argument is that it's necessary, we have no choice. Yeah, that's what the government say. Of course, not everybody agrees with them. Now, the problem with austerity policies is that although people may accept them, they're obviously not very popular. You know, nobody likes their hospitals to be closed, or they're not very popular. And so the government has a difficulty of presenting them. And one of the solutions for the Conservative government was to introduce a new slogan, a new idea. And this slogan was, big society. Now, it just sounds a bit like a joke in a way, but it wasn't a joke. So this is the new slogan of the Conservative government. Now, what does this mean? Good question. Some people say nothing, but let's see where it comes from. Well, you remember, I hope, that Margaret Thatcher's idea of society was a small state, a small public sector. If in Margaret Thatcher's opinion, if the public sector is too big, if the government has too much responsibility, this is bad. It stops people from working freely in the market, which is the best way for the economy. And so if Margaret Thatcher had a slogan, it was small states. L'État doit être réduit. Today, it sounds like very old ideas, but it's a very similar idea, big society. It's the idea that many things which were traditionally done by governments should be done by society. Now, who is society? That's not quite so clear. So let's have a look. What the government said was important. They said, we need a government which gives more power to local people and communities. We need a big society that will take power away from politicians and give it to people. Okay, so you see the idea. This is the presentation of the policy. I will give you some examples in a moment. Now, of course, some people thought this was an excellent idea. The Times, for example, the Times newspaper said, this is an impressive attempt to reframe the role of governments and unleash entrepreneurial spirits. Alors, selon The Times, c'est une tentative impressionnante de recadrer le rôle du gouvernement et libérer l'esprit de l'entrepreneur. Of course, other people were critical. For example, the Archbishop of Canterbury, donc le chef de l'Église d'Angleterre, bon, le chef c'est la reine, mais le premier évêque de l'Église d'Angleterre, said, this is aspirational waffle designed to conceal a deeply damaging withdrawal of the state from its responsibilities to the most vulnerable. Alors, comment on traduit ça? C'est du gros n'importe quoi, conçu pour cacher un retrait très dangereux de l'État de ses responsabilités envers les plus vulnérables de notre société. Now, this is an interesting point because when the Archbishop of Canterbury criticizes a conservative government, this is not good for the conservative government because, of course, the Church of England is really a very conservative organization. And so that is one element. Okay, so let me see if I can give you a couple of examples of what big society was supposed to be. More devolution, more local power, more encouragement of volunteerism. So, volunteerism, c'est le travail bénévole, le travail associatif. C'est ce que font beaucoup de gens hein, pour aider les voisins ou autres. And so, the government fundamentally was saying, because of the economic crisis, we don't have money to have the same public services as before, so we must encourage people to do volunteer work. For example, some of the libraries reduced the number of staff and had volunteers instead. Donc il y a toute une série de bibliothèques municipales qui ont remplacé une partie du personnel par des bénévoles. Okay, so it's a particular idea. Now, of course, this is very controversial. The government is saying, this is a good idea. These are, for example, older people who are bored and they need to participate in society. And of course, the trade unions are saying, no, we are losing jobs and increasing unemployment. Yeah, it's a matter of how you look at it. One more comment. The leader of the biggest confederation of trade unions, Brendan Barber, said, David Cameron's ideal society is Somalia. L'idéal, la société idéale de David Cameron, c'est la Somalie. Parce qu'il y a très peu d'État là-bas. Donc, bien sûr, c'est une blague, c'est du sarcasme. Right, okay. So, yes? Un des dirigeants de la Confédération syndicale, Brendan Barber. Parce que le discours du gouvernement, c'est qu'il y a trop d'État. Le gouvernement intervient trop. Et alors, s'il y a bien un pays où le gouvernement n'intervient pas, c'est la Somalie. Bon, bien sûr, c'est un peu une blague quand même. La situation n'est pas comparable. Mais c'est vrai qu'en Somalie, il n'y a pas d'État, en fait. Il n'y a quasiment pas de gouvernement. Il n'y a que les... Bon, c'est le bordel. C'est bien pire que l'Angleterre. Okay, so this is one of the big debates. This has also been... Est-ce que je vais dire ça plus tard ou maintenant? Non, je vais le dire brièvement. There's also been a lot of debate about unemployed people. Unemployment is very high. Not quite so high as in France, but nearly. For several years, until 2006, unemployment in Britain was very low compared with France. But it has now become high again. There was 5 years where unemployment was really much lower in England than in France. And now it's only a little lower. You know, it was a moment where there was a golden moment. And of course, the idea of how to find people jobs so they won't be unemployed is very important. It's very important for the trade unions because they want everybody to have a job because you can live better if you have a job. It's very important for the government because unemployed people are very expensive. You have to pay money to keep them. And this has included a number of controversial cases because under a new scheme to encourage unemployed people to get a job, they have been sent into companies to work for 6 months free. Donc, c'est un nouveau dispositif pour qu'ils aient de l'expérience du travail. Ils sont envoyés dans les supermarchés, par exemple, travailler 6 mois sans être payés. 10 heures par semaine ou quelque chose comme ça. L'idée du gouvernement étant de leur donner de l'expérience du travail pour le remettre sur la bonne route. Of course, this is very controversial. There was a big campaign by the trade unions to boycott the supermarkets who accept to take people without paying. And I think that in this case, I think the government went too far. Because I have my barometer, j'ai mon baromètre, c'est ma mère qui est très conservatrice. Et elle a trouvé que faire travailler les jeunes sans le payer, c'était trop, hein, c'était pas acceptable. Alors je me dis, si ma mère est contre, c'est que vraiment ils sont allés trop loin, le gouvernement conservateur. But I think that this was generally not considered acceptable by people, that people should work for nothing. Même que, bien sûr, c'est très courant par ailleurs, les stages, on appelle ça les stages, hein. Qui sont pas toujours... Parfois, c'est du vrai travail pour rien. En principe, il y a de la formation. Parfois, il y a de la formation, mais parfois, pas vraiment, quoi. Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. Okay, so that's some of the debates about general economic policy, which are continuing. There has also been two or three big strikes of the public sector. Generally, strikes for only one day, but strikes with millions of strikers. And this is new in Britain. We're not used to this. Of course, in France, it's not new. But in Britain, it was a long time. And it seems that the trade unions have finally recovered from the 1984 miners' strike. Yeah, it probably took 30 years, yeah? But it seems like it's over now. What are another couple of important questions which are being debated and solved to some extent in Britain today? Well, there is the question of four nations, the questions of devolution, the devolution of Scotland, the devolution of Wales, and a slightly more complicated question, the devolution of Northern Ireland. Now, I haven't spoken to you very much about devolution, so I'm going to go back into history a little bit. But starting from today, today what is completely new and quite stunning is that in 2014, in 2 years' time, what is going to happen in 2 years' time? Does anybody know? There's going to be a referendum about what? There's going to be a referendum in Scotland about independence. So this is a major event. There is going to be a referendum in Scotland. Do you want to be an independent country? Yeah. This is not devolution, this is separation. Yeah? Completely different. Now, they will probably not win the referendum, okay? But nevertheless, the fact of a referendum, just like there was a referendum in Catalonia a few weeks ago about independence. So, the idea of separating Scotland from England is supported today by approximately 30% of people in Scotland. That's a lot of people. So let's have a look at that. Yes? Oh, absolutely, yeah, independent. This is independence, yeah? It's not devolution or autonomy, it's independence, a separate army, absolutely. That's a good point, yeah? Yeah. So this is something completely new and completely different. So where does this come from? Well, let me go back into history a little bit for Scotland. Let's stay with Scotland. The Scottish have already had two referendums, not about independence, but about devolution. You know what devolution is? Devolution is when you have a separate parliament, but this parliament only has limited power. So in 1979, there was a referendum in Scotland. Do you want an autonomous parliament in Edinburgh? Yeah, that was the question. And this parliament was imagined with the power to make decisions about health, education, tourism, town planning, but not about the economy, defence, energy, etc. Yeah, so you see, it's a power, but in a small, in a limited section. And the Scottish said, in 1979, the Scottish had a small majority said yes, 52%, something like that. But the problem was most people, a lot of people stayed at home, and the result was not sufficient to establish an autonomous parliament. So in 1979, there was a referendum, and the result was no autonomous parliament. And so in the 1980s, the same situation continued, only one parliament in Britain, in London. In 1997, there was another referendum. And the situation had changed. First of all, because one of the problems of the Thatcher government is that it had very little support in Scotland. In general, Scotland had a more left-wing orientation. And at one point, there were no Conservative members of Parliament in Scotland. Zero. And so, of course, the Scottish nationalists were rather unhappy. We have no Conservative members of Parliament in Scotland, but the only government is in London, it's Conservative. And so the idea of an autonomous Parliament became more popular during the 80s. I should remind you that the feeling, national identity in Scotland is very strong. If you go to Scotland, vous savez qu'en France, souvent, au lieu de lire la Grande-Bretagne, on dit Angleterre et personne ne remarque. On fait comme ça. On sait qu'on ne devrait pas, mais bon. If you say this in Scotland, you can lose friends. Huh? If you say, oh, here in England, I like this, and it's not, they don't think this is funny. There is a real national identity. I went to see one of my friends in Edinburgh, and she's an intellectual and she has a lot of books. But I was very surprised because there was a section, there was a bookshelf, and it was Scottish novels, Scottish poems, Scottish history books. Yeah. Enormous, yeah? It wasn't just, you know, a few. It's a real national identity, very strong. For example, now in Scotland, all of the road signs, les panneaux routiers, are in two languages, in English and in Scots Gaelic. Scots Gaelic and Gaelic. And Gaelic. However, only 2% of the population of Scotland speak Scots Gaelic. C'est une langue vaguement liée au breton. C'est une langue celte. Okay. Yeah, okay. Why are all the road signs in Gaelic when only 2% of people can understand Gaelic? What do you think? Why do people want all the road signs in English and Gaelic when in fact they don't speak Gaelic? Say again? Is it
identity?
It is. It's a symbol for their identity, absolutely. I don't think so, really. I don't think they're going to learn Gaelic.
Perhaps for whatever losing their history or the language.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about roots, it's about identity, it's a symbol. It's a symbol of national identity. Yeah, we want to see our language even though we don't speak it. So important sense of Scottish identity. And therefore, in 1997, the second referendum, they answered, yes, we want a parliament in Edinburgh. And in 1998, a new parliament was established in Edinburgh, in Holyrood. And there were elections for the Scottish government and the Scottish First Minister. Be careful with the vocabulary. In London, you have the Prime Minister, and in Edinburgh, you have the First Minister. And this Scottish Parliament now makes a lot of decisions about education, health, tourism, etc., but not about the economy, defence, etc., the central questions. Now, the Scottish Nationalists continued to become popular. The Scottish National Party had a few members of Parliament in London. Les Trente d'hiver, il y a quelques nationalistes écossais dans ce cours. And in 2011, last year, there were elections for the Scottish Parliament, and the Scottish National Party got a majority. So the government in Edinburgh is Scottish National Party, qui est un parti qui a comme principe l'indépendance, même si la plupart des électeurs, ses électeurs, ne sont pas. And they promised that they would have a referendum on independence. And there will be this referendum on independence in 2014. The Scottish National Party is very happy. In 1950, they were a tiny little party. In 1970, they didn't have a lot of influence. In 1979, they had some influence, but they lost the referendum. And now they are the government in Edinburgh, and they are organising a referendum on independence. In February 2012, a few months ago, David Cameron went to visit Edinburgh to discuss the question of the referendum. And it was a very interesting visit because the Scottish government welcomed the Prime Minister as if he was a visitor from a foreign country. An official visitor from a foreign country. It was very interesting symbolism. David Cameron has accepted that the referendum is possible, and it will go ahead. Now, the highest level of popularity for independence in Scotland has been 37%. So they will probably lose. The Scottish Nationalists will probably lose the referendum. But first of all, it's not absolutely impossible. 37% is a lot, you know, you just keep going up. But secondly, it's a question of negotiation. That is to say that if the vote for independence is 35%, then the Scottish National Party will be in a strong position to negotiate more devolution. Because s'ils ont un vote élevé pour l'indépendance, ils seront bien placés pour négocier une autonomie renforcée. Pas encore l'indépendance, mais autonomie renforcée. And that is probably what is going to happen. There have been a couple of interesting reforms in preparation for the referendum. For example, in this referendum, for the first time, people will be able to vote if they are over 16. Not over 18, over 16. So they have reduced the age of voting for the referendum, an interesting new change.
Il y avait quelqu'un qui proposait que des Écossais qui ne vivaient pas en Écosse devraient avoir le droit de vote. Mais ça a été rejeté parce que c'était considéré comme trop compliqué. Mais même la proposition est fascinante comme idée.
Okay, they have passed all the laws which are necessary. Each
The Yes campaign and the No campaign can spend £750,000 each on the campaign. There is a maximum, there's a limit on how much money can be spent on the campaign. And there is a lot of discussion about what exactly should be the question. Because perhaps you know, but when you have a referendum, the exact words of the question are very important.
Si vous mettez deux questions, c'est des exemples idiots, hein, mais si vous mettez la question, est-ce que vous êtes d'accord avec Adolf Hitler que la violence est essentielle à la politique? Les gens ils disent non. Si vous mettez, est-ce que vous êtes d'accord avec Nelson Mandela que la violence est essentielle dans la politique? Les gens disent oui. C'est un exemple idiot, mais la question, ça peut changer quelque chose. And the question which has been suggested is this one. Do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country? So the question, do you think that's an objective question? Or is that a... Not so. Why not? You're not so sure it's objective. It's difficult. It's a difficult question. A difficult analysis. Yeah. Yes. Well. Yes. That's certainly true. Some people say, which is probably true, if you begin, do you agree? Ça encourage une réponse positive. Ce qui est sûr, que si vous posez la question « Do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country ?» Vous n'avez pas exactement le même résultat que si vous posez la question « Do you agree that Scotland should remain in the United Kingdom ?» Yeah. Il y a un avantage pour le « Do you agree ?» Ok, so this is the big question. For some time, there was a suggestion to give three possibilities. Independence, the present situation, or... maximum devolution. Et on a vu arriver un nouveau mot qui n'existait pas avant, Divomax, dévolution maximum, ou un peu autonomie renforcée, si vous voulez. Yeah. And that's the new word, Divomax. It's the new political word there. Okay, so we will see what is going to happen there. Of course, if Scotland did become an independent state, it would not be the smallest one in Europe. Well, there are many states in Europe which are smaller. And the economic situation of Scotland would change because, of course, there is a lot of oil in Scotland. Beaucoup de pétrole. Okay, so that's an interesting question. The question of defence would obviously be a problem, first of all, because they would need a separate army, but secondly, because British nuclear weapons are in Scotland, and naturally that would become a rather delicate question. There we go. Yet the present percentage of people supporting independence, the maximum was 39%. Là, j'ai une liste de sondages et le plus grand nombre qui soutiennent l'indépendance, ça a été 39%. Okay. I'm going to stop there for today.